This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Conviction, the untold story of putting Jodi Arias behind bars by Juan Martinez. Read by Patrick Lawler. Prologue. On the morning of Jodi Ann Arias's sentencing, I woke up early. It's not every day that 7 years' worth of work comes to an end, and this was like the ending of a bad relationship. The only things left to say were the words that Arias did not want to hear. It had all begun on June 4, 2008, the day Arias's victim and former boyfriend, Travis Alexander, had been brutally murdered. And now, after years of motions and discovery, appearances and court dates, a conviction of first-degree murder, and two hung juries tasked with deciding whether Arias should receive the death penalty, we were back at the courthouse on April 13, 2015, ready to hear the sentence as determined by the judge. In the aftermath of the hung juries, the death penalty was no longer an option, but the judge could send her to prison for either natural life or life with the possibility of release after 25 years. Courtroom 5C of the Maricopa County Superior Court was packed to capacity, as it had been for much of the trial. There had never been a crowd like this in our courtrooms. The interest in the case was unprecedented. Maybe it was the attractive defendant and the handsome victim, or the fact that they were both Mormon, or the buzz about the kinky sexual relationship between them. Whatever the reason, there were always more people than there were seats, and eventually it had gotten to the point where people started lining up early in the morning just to get in. I took the same chair at the counsel table that I had taken every day during the trial. Looking around the room, I realized that I'd spent years of my life here. The judge's bench in front of me, jury box to my left, and defense table to my right. I glanced across the courtroom at Arias. It was hard to reconcile her to the woman she was at the start of all this. She was still a brunette, only now her hair was laced with strings of gray. She looked older in other ways, too, from the glasses she wore to the wrist brace on her left arm. But more than physical appearances, I couldn't help but think about her untruthful side and the different airs she'd worn. Arias had always struck me as the bad waitress type. I imagined her at the Purple Plum, a restaurant in Yreka, California, where she had once worked. She would probably be looking down at her customers, smiling at them with a fake happy look like she always did, giving them bad service. It was easy to see her spending her days taking photos, pouring weak coffee, and dreaming of a different life. Instead, she was standing in front of a judge ready to be sentenced for the premeditated murder of Travis Alexander. Even now, I could picture her saying, "Judge, it wasn't my fault." Just as she might say to her customers, "It's not my fault the coffee is cold." I had never heard her take responsibility for anything, and I didn't expect to hear her take responsibility today. The proceedings got underway at 8:40 a.m., with the bailiff calling the courtroom to order and the judge announcing the case. "It is now time to enter judgment and sentence," the judge said. "It is the judgment of the court that the defendant, Jodi Ann Arias, is guilty of the crime of first-degree murder." Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Sherry Stevens had been with us through it all, witnessing up close the heated exchanges that marked so much of the case. She turned to me and asked if I had any comments. I had something to say, but protocol was to let Travis Alexander's family members speak first. They were in the front row on the left side of the courtroom, as they had been for the duration of the trial. The three rows behind them were filled with those members of the media who were able to get a seat. The overflow media used another room equipped with closed-circuit television. Travis's Aunt Heather spoke first. His sisters Hillary, Tanisha, and Samantha were next. Their statements were difficult and emotional, and I felt the weight of their loss as I rose to make my statement. "Hope is never a bad thing," I started. "Hope is always a good thing. The family of Travis Alexander, as you heard, hoped that a death sentence would be imposed by this case. But that is not to be. That will not happen. But they still have hope. They have hope now that you will see your way to a natural life sentence. As they have told you, when they think of the stabbing, they can feel their brother's pain. They can feel the blade going into him, and it burns them. When they feel him moving away, trying to get away from Arius, as she continually stabbed him, they can hear his cries, his screaming. It rings in their ears, and it's something they cannot stop. After my statement, Arius's mother rose to talk on her behalf, and as expected, she defended her daughter. Finally, it was Arius's chance to speak. From the start of the trial, people had wanted to see how I would handle the crafty, manipulative defendant who had the ability to be sympathetic and demure at a moment's notice. I knew I had been able to cut through her posturing and expose her for who she really was, a cold-hearted murderer who refused to own up to the especially cruel crime she'd committed. I had been hard on her, but I had to be. I had prosecuted 181 jury trials, 72 of which involved a charge of murder, but I had never seen a defendant quite as calculating as the woman standing before the judge now. If I'd allowed her to dictate the pace of the questioning during cross-examination, she might have had her way and gotten away with murder. Her statement was much shorter than I had anticipated. Of course, as I had predicted, she still refused to take responsibility for anything. Instead, she was the victim. She had had to defend herself during the over-the-top murder of Travis. She had had to protect his reputation both while they were dating and in the days and months after his death. She was not the one who wanted the case to go to trial, but Travis's sisters had rejected plea bargaining. She was the one who needed sympathy, even pointing me out by name as one of her tormentors. "I do remember the moment when the knife went into Travis's throat," she said, "and he was conscious. He was still trying to attack me. It was I who was trying to get away, not Travis, and I finally did. I never wanted it to be that way, Judge. The gunshot did not come last. It came first, and that was when Travis lunged at me, just as I testified to. And just as the state's own detective testified 2 years ago, before he and Juan got together and decided to change their story for the trial." As she said those words, Arius physically pointed at me and used my first name. She appeared to be losing her composure. In my long career, I'd been personally attacked in the courtroom before, and this was no different. But perhaps it made her feel better. As it turned out, her pointed gesture was just the start. As her statement continued, it seemed she remembered more about the attack than she had ever let on. For years, she had said that she was in a fog about the details of the crime, only remembering certain fragments of images, her running around the bedroom, finding the gun, shooting Travis, and the knife dropping. Now, in an apparent moment of anger, she recalled another detail, an important one. Arius, 7 years later, recalled that Travis was conscious after she slit his throat. This was typical of the selective memory she exhibited every one of those 18 days she had spent on the stand. Beyond the lifting of the fog, there was something else to her words in this final statement, something more telling. As she stood in front of the judge trying to win the chance to be released after serving 25 years, she made it my fault that she had been found guilty, claiming that I had changed the facts about the gunshot to make my case easier to prosecute. Of course, medical science, not I, had proved that the gunshot came after Travis had already been mortally wounded by the multiple stabbings. But the fact that she was using some of her final words to the judge to attack me rather than take responsibility spoke volumes about Arius and her character. This was the vengeful woman who had killed Travis, the woman with whom I had sparred for days on the witness stand, the woman I'd convicted of first-degree murder. Chapter 1. In central Arizona during the summer, no matter what time of day it is, it can always get hotter. And as I stepped out of my car on the morning of June 10th, 2008, with the temperature already in the mid-90s, I had the distinct feeling it was going to be a particularly hot one. I'd never been to this part of Mesa, Arizona before, but taking in my surroundings, I noticed that the streets had the quiet feel of the suburbs. The neighborhood was the picture of urban tranquility, and if the empty driveways were any indication, most residents were already at work that Tuesday morning. There wasn't even a dry gust of wind stirring the trees or the sound of children playing, but I wasn't surprised by this apparent calm. I'd learned a long time ago that most murder scenes are eerily silent in the aftermath of the violence. At 8:35 that morning, I'd received a phone call from Sergeant Dana McBride, a supervisor with the Mesa Police Department, notifying me of a homicide and asking me to respond to the scene so that I could conduct a walkthrough before the victim's body was removed. The investigation was nascent, and there was only very basic information he could share. A 30-year-old man named Travis Alexander had been murdered inside his own home. I was in my 12th year with the Homicide Bureau of the Maricopa County Attorney's Office in Phoenix, Arizona, having transferred to the unit in October 1996. Prosecutors assigned to the Homicide Bureau are required to take on-call shifts, and in the event that a murder occurs during their shift, that prosecutor must go to the scene in order to become familiar with the intricacies of the case and meet with the detectives and officers working to make an arrest. Technically, my 24-hour on-call shift had ended at 8 a.m., and the call had come in after this. But although the schedule indicated that I was done at 8 o'clock, I didn't agree with such a strict approach. Besides, given that the body had been discovered the previous evening while I was still on call, it only seemed fair that I respond, rather than shirk the responsibility onto the next on-call attorney on the list. The facts that I had learned from the sergeant on the phone were that the victim shared a home with two roommates who had not seen him in a couple of days. On the evening of June 9, 2008, a friend, Marie Mimi Hall, worried about Travis's recent lack of communication, had stopped by his house. When no one answered the door, she called two friends to come meet her so they could go inside together, because she was afraid to enter on her own. One of Travis's roommates, who happened to be home and had not heard Mimi at the front door, then unlocked the master bedroom door, and the group found Travis's nude, contorted, decomposing body in the shower of the ensuite bathroom. Mimi immediately called 911 and alerted police to the situation at 10:27 p.m. Sergeant McBride added that he did not know how the victim had been killed. After hanging up, I left the office and began the approximately 30-mile drive to Mesa, a city in the East Valley. Travis Alexander's home was located in a bedroom community miles from the center of the city. As I'd driven through his neighborhood, it seemed the kind of place where people move to raise their kids, and while there are many places of worship for many denominations, I knew the area to be particularly Mormon. Grocery stores stay open late, movie theaters and restaurants abound. Crime, even petty offenses, was infrequent, and usually the only violence that touched their lives was what the residents saw on television. Travis's home was an upscale tract house, similar in style to the others in the subdivision, tan with brown trim and a Spanish-style roof. When I arrived, I walked up to the officer guarding the front door and let him know that I was ready for my walkthrough whenever the lead investigator, a detective named Esteban Flores, was ready for me. I hadn't worked with Detective Flores before, but I knew that he was reputed to be methodical and thorough in his investigations. A half hour later, I was allowed inside the home, and after I covered my shoes with protective booties, Detective Flores, a stocky former Marine in his late 30s with close-cut black hair, met me just inside the front door. As my eyes adjusted from the sunlight outside, I began to focus on each detail in the home as it was presented to me. The main reason for having prosecutors in the Homicide Bureau on call was that doing a walkthrough of the location where the murder occurred gave us first-hand knowledge of the scene and victim. While we never assisted the police in their investigation, I always tried to use the walkthrough to my advantage to get a head start on understanding the homicide I would be handling. Glancing around the home's first floor, I was struck by how orderly everything was, giving no indication that there had been trouble here. It was immaculate, and nothing seemed to be out of place. I'd been to many murder scenes, and in the majority of them, the furniture and household items inside the homes are strewn about or knocked down. Here, the only out-of-place item was a steam vacuum cleaner, which had been left standing in the middle of the living room floor. As always in a scene like this, I had my hands deep in my pants pockets to make sure I didn't touch or disturb anything, a habit I had developed years earlier. Standing beside me, Detective Flores gave me the little information about Travis the police had been able to confirm at this early stage of the investigation. Travis sold memberships through direct sales and network marketing as an independent contractor for prepaid legal services, a business that provided access to legal services for its members who paid a fee to join. His friends said he was Mormon and faithfully attended services at the local church. Detective Flores motioned me to follow him up the stairs. At the foot of the staircase was a doggy gate that had been pushed aside by the same friends who had discovered the body. The victim's dog, Napoleon, a black pug, had already been removed from the house and was with one of Travis's friends. We speculated about whether the dog had been there for some time without food or water, but noticed that at least there was a sliding pet door that allowed him to go in and out of the house. At the top of the stair landing on the right, there was a makeshift home theater with beanbag chairs, a big screen TV and DVD player, a projector, and movie posters on the walls, including ones of Humphrey Bogart, Al Pacino, the Rat Pack, and Marilyn Monroe. Nothing there was disturbed, although there was a camera case lying next to one of the beanbag chairs. The camera itself was missing. To the left were double doors that opened into the master bedroom. The first thing I noticed when I walked in was that the room felt cool. The air conditioner had been set to the mid-70s, making the room seem chilly compared to the heat outside. The king-size bed in the center of the room had been stripped bare. There were no sheets or comforter, and a white mattress cover was balled up in the middle of the bed. Light streamed in through two windows on either side of the bed. On the nightstand was a book, 1,000 Places to See Before You Die by Patricia Schultz. Two pillows missing their pillowcases were on the floor near a pair of flip-flops. Carpet remnants had been cut and glued to the upper sole of the flip-flops in an apparent effort to make them more comfortable to wear. Taking my first steps into the room, I immediately noticed a large amount of blood on the carpet bordering the hallway leading to the bathroom. The blood was brown and crusted in an ovoid stain, with a concentration of bloody footprints around it, reminiscent of the hoofprints left at a riverbank after a wildebeest migration. These footprints started and ended around the stain, indicating that the person had been careful to avoid tracking the blood anywhere else in the bedroom. I didn't walk down the hallway that led into the bathroom, but I still could see that the tile floor was dotted with blood patches and the walls intermittently smudged with blood. There were crime lab technicians inside the hallway attempting to find any latent fingerprints. A latent print is a chance impression left at the scene of a crime that may not be immediately visible to the naked eye, or biological material for DNA testing. I also noticed a number of detectives busy searching the bed area, while others processed the large walk-in closet with a door that opened into the bedroom on one end and the bathroom on the other. Detective Flores directed that we walk through the closet on our way into the bathroom where the body had been found. Although we were wearing booties over our shoes, we ran the risk of transferring the blood on the hallway floor to other areas of the crime scene should we go down the hallway. As we passed through the closet, I noticed it was orderly and organized. Baseball caps were lined up in a row. Several pairs of Levi's, each clipped to a hanger by the hem, hung lengthwise. Casual shoes sat on a shelf above the dress shoes, each pair aligned with its mate. To the right were Travis's suits, and next to them were his shirts, which seemed to be arranged by color. In the middle of the closet was a bench for dressing and putting on shoes. A framed picture of Abraham Lincoln hung on the small space of wall between the two shelf units, as if watching over Travis's clothing. Some luggage was stored next to the door leading into the bathroom. The orderliness of the closet stood in stark contrast to the chaos of the bathroom, and as I looked around, I first saw a sink streaked with brownish-red blood. The blood covered the faucets and was splattered on the mirror. Blood was also strewn around the floor and on the baseboards, marking a grim trail either toward or away from the shower stall, where Travis Alexander's naked body lay on the floor, crammed into a fetal position, legs bent to his chest, head pressed onto his right shoulder, feet pushing against the wall. After days in this cramped repose, his extremities were turning black. It was obvious that his throat had been slashed, but there were also stab wounds visible on the upper chest. The body had apparently been rinsed off, but there was still an active discharge emanating from the gash in his throat. There was a clear 16-ounce plastic tumbler resting between his right arm and the wall of the shower. Detective Flores and I discussed two possible alternatives for the tumbler. One was that it had been used to wash the body. That explanation did not make sense because the body was already in the shower. It was more likely used in an attempt to wash away the blood in front of the sink and down the hallway, which had only served to distribute the blood to different places on the tile floor. A cardboard box on the floor of the bathroom linen closet next to the sink had soaked up some of the blood and water, leaving a light pinkish-red pattern on the sides. The cut to the throat had almost certainly been delivered with a knife, and although I hadn't seen anything resembling a gunshot wound, there was a .25 caliber casing lying on top of a small concentration of blood on the floor in front of the sink, where I first noticed a variety of blood patterns, indicating that Travis had stood there before making his way down the hallway. Police had searched throughout the house, but neither weapon had been found. Standing there, taking in the spectacle, I couldn't help but think Travis must have suffered greatly. I'd seen a lot of crime scenes since I'd joined the homicide unit, and this one spoke to an overkill. This murder seemed methodical, and I didn't think it was a crime of passion. It also seemed less angry and more purposeful. Only later would I find out just how goal-oriented the murderer had truly been, because, as it turned out, Travis had been killed three times over, stabbed in the chest next to the heart, slashed across the throat, and shot in the temple. My eyes moved slowly around the bathroom one more time. I knew that it would be memorialized in photos and diagrams and that the whole room would be cataloged and measured by the investigators now working in the master bedroom suite. I would revisit this disturbing scene many times in the future through the photographs taken and the reports yet to be written, but I wanted to preserve as much as I could in my mind so that wherever the investigation led, I wouldn't forget the bloody scene now in front of me. Flores's voice stirred me from my thoughts. "Several of Travis's friends and acquaintances keep talking about an ex-girlfriend named Jody," he said. "They all think she may have done it. They say she is a real stalker type." Flores said this Jody had already called the police department asking to speak to a detective involved in the investigation, and he was going to call her back as soon as he could. At this time, it didn't seem strange that an ex-girlfriend had called the station. More than anything, it was just interesting. As we left the upstairs bathroom, Detective Flores stated, We found a camera in the washing machine on the first floor. Let's go downstairs so you can look at it. The door of the top-loading washing machine was open, allowing me to bend over and peer inside. To the left of the agitator was a black camera nestled amid the wet clothing, indicating it had been put through the wash cycle. And from the discolored look of the brown towel also inside, it appeared that bleach had been used. "I don't know if we are going to get anything out of it," Flores told me, gesturing toward the camera, "but we are going to process it to see what we can find." I also looked inside the dryer and saw what appeared to be the missing bedding from the room upstairs. It included the king-size comforter and sheets matching the bed in the master suite. "All this took time, you know," Flores said, and I nodded in agreement. The cleanup had not been restricted to the killing scene upstairs. It was throughout the house, including the downstairs laundry room. Cleaning up after a murder scene is extremely rare. This was only the second time I had come across one manipulated to such an extent. Chapter 2. Questions about the crime scene and motive swirled around in my head as I merged onto Interstate 17, heading toward my office in downtown Phoenix. I was anxious to get back and jot down some notes while the scene was fresh in my mind. I was still on the freeway but knew I was getting close when I looked to the north and saw the copper dome of the Maricopa County Administration Building coming into view. The copper had started to turn green, which gave the building a classic look. I liked seeing it, knowing that I was almost back to my office in the nerve center of the city. The Phoenix area is a sprawling metropolis of many smaller cities collectively known as the Valley of the Sun. Land is cheap, and although people build farther and farther from downtown, the feeling of wide open space is not compromised. Over 3 million people occupy the metropolitan area's more than 500 square miles, so there seems to be room for everybody. I'd first arrived in the valley from my home state of California to attend law school at Arizona State University in August 1981. I remember driving past the school's campus in Tempe early one morning and thinking it was already quite hot. It probably seemed hotter than it really was because my car didn't have air conditioning. As I drove around, I was listening to the radio and heard the disc jockey raise his voice and announce that it was cool in Phoenix. I thought it was some sort of joke until I realized that the station's call letters were K-O-O-L. Despite the temperature that day, the pleasant year-round weather became the reason I stayed in the Phoenix area. On those very hot days, I just keep reminding myself that it is a dry heat. Besides, it really is always cool here in the valley. My 10-story cement and glass office building in downtown Phoenix spans the entire block between 3rd and 4th Avenues on West Jefferson Street. When we moved into the offices in the mid-1990s, the Maricopa County Attorney's Office occupied 4 of the 10 floors. And a few years later, the Homicide Bureau expanded onto another floor, the 4th floor. I chose the southeast corner office, which has a view of the Maricopa County 4th Avenue Jail, and have been there ever since. I like the layout of the courthouse facilities. Our building is connected to the Maricopa County Superior Court Complex, and I can walk across the bridge, a glass-enclosed walkway, to the courthouse without ever going outside. This is especially convenient on those days when the temperature rises above 110 degrees. Ours is one of the largest prosecutorial offices in the country, with more than 300 attorneys serving a population of about 4 million people. The number of employees varies, but there are usually around 900 full-time workers, including attorneys, investigators, paralegals, victim advocates, and support staff. The number of attorneys in the Homicide Bureau, now called the Capital Litigation Bureau, fluctuates, with an average of 15 attorneys, including me. Everything that happens in the legal sense happens here, so I am in the middle of the action at all times, which suits me well. It was shortly before noon by the time I finally parked my car in the garage. After a quick sandwich at the Change of Venue Cafe on the second floor of my office building, I began filling out the incident report about my walkthrough of the murder scene. It was only one page, asking for the basics, date, time, and place. In this case, investigators didn't know the date Travis Alexander was killed. His body had been found on the 9th of June, but given the state of decomposition and that Travis hadn't been heard from in a week, police couldn't tell how long he had been there just based on what they recovered at the crime scene. Where the form asked for suspects, I left it blank. But in the hours that followed, as the investigation deepened and Flores gathered more information from Travis's friends and roommates at the scene, the identity of the suspect gradually began to shift from unknown to Jody Arias. Travis's friends described Arias as clingy and a fatal attraction type. Apparently, the two of them argued a lot, so much so that one of Travis's roommates had been able to detail some of their disagreements. The main source of conflict related to Jody Arias moving to Mesa after she and Travis had broken up. She had been living in Palm Desert, California, and in July 2007, a couple of weeks after their breakup, she moved to Mesa. One of Travis's best friends, Taylor Searle, told detectives about a conversation Travis said he'd had with Arias just the previous week, during which Travis let Arias know that he did not want to ever see or talk to her again. Searle said that, according to Travis, this had made Arias very upset. Of particular interest was the information provided by Mimi Hall. She had been one of the people who found Travis's body. She told police that she had met him at a singles function at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, LDS, in Mesa. They had been spending time together as friends since about February or March, and they even went out on a couple of dates. Mimi was scheduled to travel to Cancun, Mexico with Travis on June 10th and hadn't heard from him in about a week. She had made it clear that they were only going as friends and even told him that he was free to invite someone else if that made him more comfortable. Apparently, it was too late to change the plans, so they agreed to go as friends. As the trip approached, Mimi became increasingly concerned when Travis failed to return her telephone calls, respond to her text messages, or answer her email correspondence. The night before their scheduled trip, she finally decided to go over to his house to make sure nothing was wrong. It was sometime after 9 p.m. when Mimi arrived there. Before approaching the house, she called her mother and asked that she stay on the line as a precautionary measure. She was concerned because she knew an old girlfriend named Jody had been stalking Travis, and he'd told her that she had actually followed them on one of their dates. With her mother on the phone, Mimi knocked on the door and rang the doorbell over and over again without receiving an answer. Although a light was on upstairs, no one came to the door. The only response was from Travis's dog, Napoleon, who kept barking and jumping at the door in an agitated state. Mimi was now concerned that something might have happened to Travis and called mutual friends Michelle Lowry and Dallin Forrest to come over and help her try to enter the house. A short time later, the group gained entry into the garage using the pad access code, which allowed them to walk into the house through the unlocked pantry door. They were greeted by Napoleon, who was running around downstairs. When they didn't find Travis downstairs, they went upstairs to check his bedroom, but the door was locked and nobody answered when they knocked. Travis owned the house, but to meet expenses, he rented rooms to roommates Zachary Billings and Enrique Cortez, both of whom he'd met through the LDS church. Billings was with his girlfriend in an upstairs bedroom and offered to go downstairs to get the key. After unlocking the door, Billings and Forrest entered the room to see if Travis was inside. They'd gone only a few steps when they saw the large spot of blood on the bedroom carpet. They followed the blood down the blood-streaked hallway and into the bathroom, where they found Travis's decomposing body stuffed on the floor of the shower. After seeing the body, the two men hurried out and told the others that Travis was dead, and Mimi called the police. Mimi was a dedicated Mormon girl, which was part of the reason Travis said he found her so attractive. As a devout Mormon himself, he wanted to get married and raise a family, and he believed Mimi was someone with whom he could spend the rest of his life. The problem was that after going out a couple of times, Mimi found that she was not attracted to him in that way. For his part, Travis thought she was the one and believed it was a relationship he could still explore. Mimi told police that Travis was always a gentleman during their dates, never did anything inappropriate, never even tried to kiss her. Although the relationship was platonic, she had agreed to accompany him to Cancun because she'd been there before and had enjoyed it. Mimi said she didn't know much about Jody Arias, but did know that Travis had been the one who baptized Arias into the LDS Church, and that she had moved to Mesa from California after their breakup to be near him. She described Arias as a stalker ex-girlfriend and was worried about her because she believed her to be obsessive. Travis had told her that Arias would sneak into his house through the doggy door insert in the sliding glass door leading into the kitchen. Mimi had heard that Arias had hacked into one of his online accounts, either Facebook or email, and had stolen his personal journals. She said Travis had confronted her about it. Mimi thought that Arias was dangerous enough that she feared for her safety. Police also questioned Travis's roommate, Zachary Billings. Billings said that he had started renting a room from Travis beginning in late January 2008 and was charged a monthly rent of $450. When asked about Jody Arias, Billings said that she would hang out at the house all the time when Billings first moved in back in January. He knew she had moved to Arizona from California shortly after she and Travis broke up, and that she had rented a room in a friend's house just a few miles away to be close to Travis. Billings said Arias's move had been a source of conflict between Arias and Travis. She would call at inappropriate times and show up at the house unannounced, which led to arguments between her and Travis. Billings recalled that Travis was dating someone else back in January. He couldn't remember the woman's name, but said they broke up in mid-February and that he believed Arias had been the cause. The new girlfriend didn't like that Arias was always hanging around and told Travis that until he dealt with Jody, things between them wouldn't work out. Billings recalled that when he came home on either Wednesday, June 4th, or Thursday, June 5th, the furniture on the tile floor downstairs had been moved. He said Travis had just bought an upright floor cleaner, and he noticed it standing downstairs when he first walked inside. He also said that the banister leading upstairs was slick, as if it had been cleaned. I had wondered about the upright floor cleaner when I first saw it during the walkthrough of the scene. We'd passed it on the way from the upstairs bedroom down to the laundry room. And after I saw the cleanup efforts in the bathroom, I remembered thinking that the killer might have used it to clean something up in the downstairs living room area. Billings said that eventually someone moved the furniture, with the exception of the floor cleaner, back to its proper place in the living room. He believed the other roommate, Enrique Cortez, might have done it. Police also talked with the other roommate, Cortez. Cortez said he couldn't remember for sure, but he believed that the last time he saw Travis was when he got home from work on Wednesday evening. He recalled that Travis was downstairs and talking on the phone, perhaps on a conference call. There was nothing unusual about that night, but the next night when he got home from work, he was surprised to find that the front door was locked. Travis never worried about break-ins and always kept the front door unlocked. Cortez didn't have a key and was forced to enter the house through the garage using the keypad. He recalled that as he walked through the living room, he noticed that the furniture had been moved and pushed off the tile floor. He also remembered seeing the floor cleaner in the middle of the room and assumed that Travis was getting ready to clean the tile. That evening, as he and his girlfriend were leaving the house to go to temple, They noticed Travis's CTR ring sitting on the kitchen counter. Cortez found it strange because Travis typically didn't go anywhere without it. CTR stands for Choose the Right and is worn by Mormons to remind them to resist temptation. Also out of the ordinary was that the doggy fence was up on the landing, stopping Travis's dog from going upstairs. This was unusual because Travis only restricted Napoleon's access to the living room area of the house. Detective Flores also told me about another ex-girlfriend of Travis's, Lisa Andrews, who dated Travis on and off for a number of months in 2007 and 2008. She was the one who'd mentioned Arias as one reason for her breakup with Travis. She recalled that she and Travis had fallen asleep one night while watching television in the upstairs loft area. They'd been awakened by the sound of Napoleon barking and noticed a light going off downstairs. When Travis went down to investigate, he found Arias standing in the kitchen area. She admitted to him that not only had she let herself into the house, but she had been upstairs watching them sleep. Andrews told detectives she received a threatening email from a John Doe the morning after she spent the night at Travis's house. "You are a shameful whore. Your heavenly father must be deeply ashamed of the whoredoms you've committed with that insidious man. If you let him stay in your bed one more time, or even sleep under the same roof as him, you will be giving the appearance of evil. You are driving away the Holy Ghost, and you are wasting your time. You are also compromising your salvation and breaking your baptismal covenants. Of all the commandments to break, committing the act of whoredom is one of the most displeasing in the eyes of the Lord. You cannot be ashamed enough of yourself. You are filthy, and you need to repent and become clean in the eyes of God. Think about your future husband and how you disrespect not only yourself, but him, as well as the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Is that what you want for yourself? Your future, your salvation, and your posterity is resting on your choices and actions. You are a daughter of God, and you have been a shameful example. Be thou clean, sin no more. Heavenly Father loves you and wants you to make the right choices. I know you are strong enough to choose the right. Your Father in heaven is pulling for you. Don't ignore the promptings you receive, because they are vital to your spiritual well-being." Although Andrews believed it was Arias who sent it, she had no definitive proof. Andrews also told police about an incident that had happened in February of 2008. She and Travis were at his house that evening when someone knocked on the front door. When they answered the door, there was no one there. They stepped outside to look around and still didn't see anybody, so they went back inside. The next day, they discovered that the tires on Travis's BMW had been slashed. They initially thought it was just a random act, until they heard the same knock on the front door the next night and found that Travis's tires had been slashed for a second time. Travis called police that afternoon to report the second tire slashing. But after waiting for 4 hours for officers to respond, he left because he couldn't wait any longer. I'd only been back at the office for a bit when Flores called me with another update. Apparently, in the hours after Travis's body was discovered, Arias had made a number of phone calls to others in addition to the initial call she had made to police headquarters asking to speak to a detective. Arias started calling Travis's friends, and according to them, Arias let them know she was just calling to find out what was happening. Police had encouraged one of the friends, Zachary Billings, who was standing outside of the house when his phone rang, not to answer her call. When her calls to other mutual acquaintances went unanswered, Arias called police for a second time. This time, Detective Flores said, she was insistent, almost demanding to speak with the investigating officer. This message spoke of impatience, as she indicated that she was still waiting for detectives to return her call. Arias's earlier call, asking to speak with an investigator, had not struck either of us as particularly unusual. She was an ex-girlfriend who appeared to still care for Travis. As far as police knew, she had moved to Yreka, California, a couple of months earlier and hadn't returned for a visit, and they figured she probably didn't have any useful information. On the other hand, she might be able to provide a viable lead, so it was important to return her call.
As soon as I call her, I'll get back to you with an update, but I'll hold off until I'm back at the station so that I can get the conversation on tape, Flores told me.
It was after 4 p.m. when I heard from him again. He had returned Arias's call at 2:35 p.m. and told me she was very cool and composed during their conversation. As he recapped the call, I found myself increasingly curious to hear it for myself, so I asked the detective to bring a copy of the 41-minute-14-second audio recording of their conversation to my office, because I wanted to hear Arias's voice. My first impression in listening to the call was that Arias genuinely seemed to want to help Detective Flores and sounded especially engaging as the conversation progressed.
"Well, I just wanted to offer any assistance that I might have," she began in a soft, even tone. "I was a really good friend of Travis's. I don't know a lot of anything."
"What have you heard so far?" Flores asked her.
"I heard that he was... that he passed away and that, it was... I don't know. I heard all kinds of rumors. I heard there was a lot of blood. I heard that, his roommate found him, or his friend found him, or people were... I'm sorry, it's all... I'm just upset."
"Okay."
"I heard that, he... nobody's been able to get a hold of him for almost a week, which... and that was about the last time I spoke to him, too."
"Okay,"
the detective said again, allowing Arias to fumble over her words. I knew he was purposely holding back information so he could see what it was she knew, as well as determine a possible motive for her call.
Which is actually why I thought I... My friend said I should call you anyway and let you know the last time I talked to him."
"Yeah, absolutely," Flores said, continuing the conversation.
"So...
any help we can get from anybody who had any kind of contact with him, any phone contact..."
"I used to talk to him quite regularly," Arias volunteered. "I used to live there. I live in Northern California now. But after I moved a few months ago, and after I moved, we kept in touch very regularly, and, kind of fell back a little bit. But it got down to a couple times a week. But I hadn't heard from him. I talked to him on Tuesday night."
"Okay," Flores acknowledged, continuing to offer no details.
"I looked at my phone records on the internet to check, and, so I definitely talked to him Tuesday night," Arias said, referring to the night of June 3rd.
That she had taken the time to check her phone records before speaking to police caught my interest. It seemed unusual that she would have this information at the ready in support of her alibi, especially since police had not even attempted to question her yet. Flores's tone remained steady.
"Okay, so, and that was Tuesday night? Do you remember about what time?"
I think it was, I want to say, like, 9:15, but I think it was sometime between 8 and 10, but I know it wasn't as late as 10. Probably between 8:30 and 9:30, more so, to narrow it down."
Her failure to give a time also struck me as odd, since the phone records she had supposedly reviewed include the time a call is made.
"Okay, and, what did you guys talk about?"
It was brief," Arias recounted. I was driving out to Utah, and, you know, he was like, 'Are you gonna come out and see me?' And I'm like, 'No.' And, you know, he's supposed to make a trip up here, at the end of the month, because this thing we are doing, it's called, there's a book called 1,000 Places to See Before You Die. I remembered seeing that book on Travis's nightstand when I visited the crime scene, so I was curious to hear what Arias had to say about it. "It's been featured on the Travel Channel and all that," she continued, her voice animated, "and we sort of got into that last year when we were starting to see all these different places on the list, and we thought, you know, 1,000 places is a lot of places, but why not? That would be a fun goal. So we each kind of have that goal."
Arias's claim that she and Travis were intending to travel together later in the month also struck me as strange, because I knew Travis's friends had painted her as a kind of a stalker ex-girlfriend, so it didn't make sense that they would be making plans to go away together.
"Was that trip already scheduled, or is it just something you guys talked about?" Flores asked.
Arias stumbled over her answer. Wasn't officially, like, dated. I had been trying to reach him so I could solidify my own schedule, because I was planning on making a trip down there. It was supposed to happen in May, and then, supposed to happen last week, and that didn't work out, so he was gonna leave for Cancun today, and then he said as soon as he gets back from Cancun, he was gonna make the trip."
I could hear in the detective's voice that he was taking notes as he moved the conversation back to the subject of Travis's death.
"Did he have any issues with anybody here in town? Any enemies? Anybody that wanted to do him harm?"
"You know," Arias replied, "he got his tires slashed. It was last year. He said he was worried about that. And I was worried about that. He never locked his doors, and I told him, I would tell him, 'Lock your doors,' and he'd be like, 'You're not my mom, you know?'"
By now, Flores had already been told about the tire-slashing incident and knew that all of Travis's friends were pointing to Arias as the culprit, although he didn't let on what he knew. Instead, he asked her about her relationship with Travis.
"How would you describe your relationship with him?"
From Arias's tone, which was upbeat and positive, it appeared she liked talking about this topic.
"We dated for like 5 months," she recounted, "and we broke up and we continued, actually, to see each other for quite a bit, right up until I moved. We officially broke up June 29th of last year. Even though we broke up and we were no longer boyfriend and girlfriend, we decided to remain friends. But, you know, I kind of feel embarrassed talking about this, but it was more than friends, but it wasn't boyfriend and girlfriend. It was more like kind of buddies. Do you know what I mean?"
"Okay. So you guys were not, like, romantically, together at any time of—"
We were intimate, but I wouldn't say romantic as far as the relationship goes," Arias responded in a matter-of-fact tone. "We were in no way headed toward marriage, or talking about anything like that. We hung out probably sometimes."
"Now, you say intimate," Flores repeated in an attempt to verify what he had just been told. Does that include, like, a sexual relationship with him?"
"Yeah, it does."
Arias's confirmation added an interesting wrinkle to the story, one that would continue to unfold as the investigation into Travis's death continued.
"If you could keep it confidential for now?" Arias asked, implying a concern with protecting Travis's reputation. "Because I know that it's, you know, he's Mormon and it's seriously looked down upon in our church, and I mean, I'm telling you this to be helpful in any way I can," she explained.
When asked about the last time she saw Travis, Arias maintained that it was in early April. She couldn't remember for sure, but claimed it was sometime between April 7th and 10th, when she left Mesa to return home to Yreka, California.
"Did you stop by the house, when you rented the U-Haul to say goodbye to him?" Flores asked.
"Oh, yeah. In fact, I was almost completely moved out of my house for about a week afterward, and I just stayed at his house the whole time. I mean, I practically lived there even when I was there. I spent the night there several times a week while I lived there. I came over and cleaned his house a lot. He paid me a little bit every month to keep his house clean and nice, sort of like a housekeeper.
But you haven't physically been here since you left.
Since I moved, no, I haven't.
Arius said before launching into a lengthy explanation about her intention of staying at Travis's house while he was away in Cancun. She claimed that Travis's house was always open to her as long as she gave him a heads up.
I was going to go this week, actually, while he, Travis, was in Cancun, and stay at his house, but I just... it's not in the budget.
Okay. Was that something that you guys had scheduled? That you were going to come down and stay at his house when he was gone?
Yeah, or no, actually. Not... that's what I emailed him about last week, because it was kind of last minute,
Arius claimed.
Because I was going to go, I'm looking at a calendar here, I was going to go not this week, but the next week, and then he was going to come up here that following week, which was the 4th of July. And, I know it sounds kind of weird, we're all like travelers, and I figured, you know, it would be a good idea if I would have a place to stay. His house is open all the time to friends. I mean, anybody in his business or anybody that comes to visit, he gives up his bed. He'll sleep on the couch. He let them have the whole room. So it just didn't seem he said that the door is always open, so I would have felt totally okay just showing up and staying at his house and eating his frozen dinners, etc., etc. And he would have been fine with that, too. And I just, you know, he said, just always give me a heads up. So I asked him, you know, let me know if that's cool. If not, I'll make other arrangements. And I never heard back.
Something about Arius's tone and the way she stumbled over her words raised my suspicions. Her answers included too many details, all designed to paint an idyllic picture of their post-breakup relationship, which was clearly at odds with what others were saying.
And when was that email sent out? Flores asked.
Just a few days ago. I'm in front of my computer, so I can check right now for you,
Arius told him, appearing a little too willing to corroborate her claim.
Let's see. I sent one on June 7th. Haven't heard back from you.
That he was already dead when this email was sent was not lost on me.
He got a little bit upset when I said I wasn't driving out to see him, she pronounced, suddenly moving the conversation in a darker direction. But he gets upset real easily. I don't know, he likes to hang it over me a little bit, and we kind of guilt each other sometimes.
So you guys still had a fairly decent relationship as friends?
We did.
'Cause the people that we talked to, said that you guys, that your relationship was kind of rocky and, it got a little crazy at times.
Arius did not miss a beat in responding.
What happened was when I broke up with Travis around last year because it was all really dumb. It was a bunch of drama. I had the suspicion that he was cheating on me, and so I looked in his phone and found out, and I found all these text messages, and, like, it just all blew up, and it was like we realized we couldn't trust each other, so, I mean, we broke up at that point. But we were still attracted to each other, and we still loved each other. So it wasn't the best thing, but we still hung out all the time together.
Detective Flores kept the conversation moving with questions about the furnishings and bedding in Travis's bedroom, which Arius answered in great detail. I found her somewhat chatty for someone talking to a police officer about the death of an ex-boyfriend. When asked how she learned of Travis's death, she put forth the name of a mutual friend, Daniel Freeman.
I met him last year with his sister when we all took a trip out to the Grand Canyon and to Sedona, she offered.
So he called you last night and told you what happened?
Yeah, he did. He didn't have a lot of information.
Any idea what everybody's talking about? What everybody's saying? What their suspicions are? Flores asked.
For the first time, Arias sounded flustered. She stepped over her words until she was finally able to formulate a coherent response. She explained that most of her information had come from the bishop from her church ward in Mesa, and that it mostly related to what police had done thus far in their investigation.
He basically said that they took everybody and separated them. And I don't know who everybody is.
After saying she'd called around to get additional information, she added,
And I heard from my friend, that there was a lot of blood.
Her voice filling with emotion.
And I don't know if that's just a rumor that's going around or if it's true.
Okay, well, I can tell you that we are investigating it as a homicide, Flores informed her. She appeared eager to educate the detective on Travis's physical strength, explaining that in an attempt to get into shape for his impending trip to Cancun, he had begun a diet and exercise regimen that had him taking nutritional supplements and engaging in intense workouts with heavy dumbbells.
And he's so strong. I mean, there are a couple of times we've tried to wrestle just for fun, and he showed me some moves, and there's just no, like, I don't see how anyone, unless maybe there were two people, I don't see how anyone could overpower him.
She seemed to be telling Flores to not even waste his time considering her as a suspect, because her physical strength was no match for Travis's. But she didn't stop there, and in what appeared to be an attempt to influence the investigation, went even further by advising him to look for two people. Why would somebody want to hurt him? Flores asked. Did he owe somebody money? Did he have any worries or concerns about anybody?
Arias claimed that Travis did owe people money, including one outstanding loan from a friend for about $6,000, but she insisted the lenders were all good friends who would never harm him if he failed to make good on his loans. Flores was about 30 minutes into the call when he advised Arias that certain people his detectives had interviewed had not portrayed her in the best light.
I don't want to make you feel bad, but they didn't have the best of things to say about you.
Arias's one-word reply belied no emotion.
Okay, she responded.
He went on to describe some of the things that Travis's friends had told the investigators.